Elroy Chester is a prisoner. If Texas has its way, he'll be dead within the hour. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where prison workers are getting ready to execute Chester by injecting him with a deliberate drug overdose. During the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will broadcast live coverage and commentary on the killing in Texas, which carries out more than one-third of all U.S. executions. Chester's execution will be the 499th in Texas during the modern era, a record no other state comes close to matching. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, with criminal defense attorneys Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Mike Gillespie, and Jack Lee. Huntsville reporter outside the death house Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Dave Atwood, and special guest Catherine Black, a capital defense attorney whose client, Dwayne Buck, is at the nexus of a debate about some racially charged testimony. The execution watch for Elroy Chester begins.
Good evening, this is Ray Hill. This is Execution Watch on Wednesday, the 12th of June, 2013. It is just after 6 o'clock p.m., and we have Pat Hartwell calling from Huntsville. Pat, this is Ray. You're on the air.
How are you today, Ray? It's a very solemn moment up here at Huntsville. There's about 20 of us that have come to witness outside the execution of Elroy Chester, who is obviously a mentally handicapped person that got convicted out of Jefferson County. We have people here from the Methodist Church that hosted Juan Fernandez, I believe is his name.
Yes.
That spent 18 years on death row and was innocent. And he is traveling the country now telling his story. We have people here from Willis, Texas. We have people here from Spring, Texas. We also have two gentlemen I just met that came from Houston that heard about us that just wanted, said they opposed the death penalty and they wanted to see what was going on. But the most important person here, of course, is the sister of Elroy Chester, who does not want to be on the radio right now. She's
But she's out there with you. She didn't go in to witness.
No, she's not into witness. She's out here with us.
Okay, have the witnesses crossed the road?
No, they have not. I understand that the arguments are still before the Supreme Court, and so we will have to wait to see what comes down from the Supreme Court. We're all out here in this horrible heat waiting.
Okay, Pat, any foreign media around?
Yes, there is a film crew from the Netherlands, I believe. Right now, they are behind the barrier that they put up between us and the people that want to see the state of Texas kill someone. So they're up in front of the building where the witnesses will come out.
Okay, Pat, it is customary for the abolition movement to be outside the death chamber on occasions of executions. And I wanted to tell folks that if they wanted to know more about the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement, you can find them at their website, which is www.abolitionmovement.org.
And you can also find us on Facebook under the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement.
Okay, thank you very much, Pat. Pat, when they cross the road, call Elizabeth is here.
I sure will.
Yeah,
I sure
just
will.
Wait a minute. I just got a phone call from the PR people at the Supreme Court,
yes.
And they say that Mr. Chester's petitions have been turned down.
Okay, so the witnesses should be crossing the road. Notify Elizabeth when that happens anyway, would you, Pat?
Yes, I will.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
All right. And so that that catches up. Apparently, this execution is going to proceed without any action by the Supreme Court of the United States. Normally, we hear from Gloria Rubeck there, and it was announced earlier that you would. But instead, Gloria is in the studio with us tonight. She had a traffic court matter to resolve, but I understand that she went over there and kicked some butt and took care of taking a few names. Jim? What happened in this case?
What happened, Ray, is pretty simple. everyone.
Yeah, making sure your mic's on.
All right. Okay, here we go. What happened? There was, according to the evidence, Chester...
A little closer.
Eloy Chester was out on parole for burglary.
Wait a minute. We're going to have switch mics here, Mike. But we have Dave. Dave?
Yeah.
Are you there?
I'm here, Ray.
Okay, where is here?
Here is at the corner of Main and Vins by the museums.
Oh, okay. And how many folks are out there with you?
We've got 10 people here.
Mercy, there's 20 people in Huntsville and 10 there. Uh-huh. That's pretty good turnout for this Texas heat weather.
Yeah, right. I agree with you.
I understand that you have been corresponding with Elroy for a while, and you have a letter from him?
Yes, I do. It's not very long. You want me to go ahead and read it?
Go ahead, please.
Okay. It's a letter to teenagers. I asked him when I was visiting him, I asked him if he would like to leave something behind to try to tell young people to avoid some of the problems that he faced. So this was the letter that he wrote, and I'm paraphrasing it because it's just his English was very difficult to read. It says, "Dear teenagers, my name is Elroy, and Mr. David asked me to share my little life story with you. When I was in ninth grade, when I started to go to jail for smoking some weed, I thought that was cool. My friends told me it was, so I did it. My mom told me all the time that trouble is easy to get into, but hard to get out of. I started stealing and breaking into houses and went to jail when I was 17 years old. When my mom died, a part of me died. I didn't care about anything no more. The first time I went to prison, I was scared. It was so big. When I got out, I worked at Luby's for about 11 months. But I went back to prison for doing some weed, and this time I was there for 4 years. After I got out, it took me about 3 months to get on that rock and weed again. This time I was going into people's houses when they were home. God knows I didn't mean to murder anyone. I was on those bad drugs. I know some of you might think, and this is to the teenagers again. I know some of you might think that dropping out of school is cool. You might think that selling rock is a way to get fast money, and that's good. But remember, there is always a price to pay when you break the law. If your mom tells you some things to look out for, listen to her." And it goes just one last sentence here. Listen to her, because if you go to prison, prison guards will tell you when to go to rec, when to sleep, and when to eat. Now I am on death row because I made some bad mistakes in my life. So listen to my little story. Remember, trouble is easy to get into, but hard to get out of. Signed, Elroy Chester. And he put a P.S. in there, which I'll read to you. He says, "P.S., Mr. David, he's a cool old guy."
Okay.
P.S. at the end.
Okay, cool old guy. Would you duplicate that? We'd like to put a picture of that on the website.
I will. I'll definitely do it.
Thank you, David. Give our regards to the other vigilants, and I need to tell folks to keep up with Dave and his crew in the work. You can reach them at www.tcadp.org, and that is an acronym for Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.org.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, David. Bye-bye. And now, Jim Skelton.
As Dave was telling you, Euler Chester was doing some burglaries in the city of Beaumont. And what happened this particular evening, he had been casing a house and realized he'd burglarized it once before, and he's looking through the window and realized there's only one adult in the house, a 17-year-old girl. He went into the side door and grabbed her and kind of led her around by the hair of the head and a gun to her head, and they gathered up a lot of valuables like jewelry and what little values there were there. While they were doing this, the 17-year-old girl's 14-year-old sister arrives with her boyfriend. He gets them both of them in the house, and he ends up taping them up with duct tape and putting them in the bathroom. Then he brings the two girls out, and he sexually assaults a 17-year-old beside the sister. Then afterwards, he made both girls have oral sex with him with a gun at their head. And when this was over, he heard a noise and realized that a gentleman was coming to the door who was the uncle of the two girls who came by to check on the girls, because when the mother of the girls were working, he always came by to check on them. When the uncle comes to the back door, he gets shot through the chest and dies immediately. He drags his body into a bedroom. And then he goes out to leave, and when he goes to leave, the girls lock the house and lock him out. And he gets outside and sees that the man he had just shot, that his girlfriend was sitting in the car with the motor running, and he tried to get in the car. She locked the doors, and he shot the locks, wasn't successful with that. Then he shot through the window several times, did not kill her. Then he immediately fled from the scene, was caught right afterwards. When he was caught, he not only confessed to everything to this, they, of course, led him to the gun, which the ballistics proved with the guns used in the shooting. He confessed to the sexual assaults. He confessed to some murders that he committed prior to that and admitted pretty much the fact he was making his living by burglaries. And one of the things he said that really hurt him, at least when he talked to the police, that he learned to hate white people when he was in prison, and that he enjoyed doing burglaries and thought burglaries were fun. And so he pretty well confessed to this murder. He confessed to other murders. And then his attitude was pretty cavalier about
all that. So there wasn't a trial on guilt or innocence?
There was a trial, but it was a maximum to discuss that. He entered a plea of guilty, which is really unusual in a capital case to enter a plea of guilty, and I've asked Mike to discuss that.
Mike?
Well,
closer to the microphone, Mike,
yes,
please.
Yes, sir. Lawyers are hired to try cases. Lawyers go to law school to try cases. Lawyers are trial attorneys. It's against a lawyer's nature to plea a case. So the first thing you have to wonder is, why would a lawyer plea a case when he has an opportunity to try a case? Well, the main reason you want to plea a case is maybe to benefit your client. You can have somebody who does something of a bad nature, but there's sympathetic reasons why he could communicate and get a break from a jury. Texas has got two different trial systems. The first trial is for guilt or innocence, and the second trial is for punishment. There's an old theory that says that when the same jury is going to punish you, heard the guilt or innocence, that the first time they hear from you, if you tell them the truth that you did it and you're sorry, they might be sympathetic at punishment. So there is a sound strategy to plea a case before trial. Another strategy to it is sometimes the state's not ready for you. They're all sitting for these witnesses for guilt or innocence, and your client stands up and says to the jury, I'm guilty, I did it. It takes the wind out of everybody's sails. The problem with this case is that there's no punishment that could have been mitigated. The facts of this case were so bad, the most he could have gotten was life in prison. With these facts, he wouldn't have got life in prison. So why a lawyer would not try this case befuddles me, because it's our nature to try the case. There are certain disadvantages to doing what he did. I talked about the advantages, maybe a break in punishment, but the big disadvantages is you ruined your appellate record. You're agreeing to the facts of the case, and by agreeing to the facts of the case, you don't have the right to appeal as much as you would. You can only appeal punishment.
Let me explain to the people, appeals are about mistakes made by the court during the process.
That's correct.
And if you cut off half the process, you surrender the first half of the process, you don't know what mistakes the state and the judge may have made in that.
Let me give a very simple example of a case that I'm familiar with that is a prime example of that, how that happens. There was a lawyer in town who had a murder case, and I believe it might not have been capital, but it was a murder case. They tried the case, and the client was found guilty. But after finding guilty, he checked the juror's records and found that one of the jurors was on probation. That made that juror a bad juror. He had lied on his jury application.
Yeah.
So the case got reversed, and when the client came back to court, the client got probation. That's an error that happened that wouldn't have happened if he had pled guilty. The lawyer did due diligence and found a technical error with the juror that was unqualified. And by the time it went up and came back again, everything had changed.
So getting a new trial, another bite at the apple, if you would, might have nothing to do with the client.
It's got to do with the lawyer. A very good lawyer knows appellate steps so well that he can bait the DA in making a mistake that the DA does not even recognize. But you can see it in a good trial attorney. He'll get that glint in his eyes that says, I got you. because he knows the level of where the DA can step over, and he tricked the DA to step over that. That's lawyering. That's what you do. Sometimes the only victory you have is to come back another day and fight. That's all you have.
Yeah.
Now, this is a case in which the client obviously gave him a hard time. This is a case in which the real problem is, how do you control a client who has done these things? When you hear quotes about he's going to get his homeboys to come and get people, you have to be concerned at how the lawyer reacts to this. So the next question you have is, how do you handle a client who wants to testify? How do you do that? How do you tell a client that is not in his best interest to testify at the stand? And it's very difficult to do. Some lawyers believe what you need to do is cover your butt by letting the whole world know that he's doing this, I'm not doing this, here I am, an open court judge, I want to try this case, my client wants to plead the case, I don't agree with this, but he wants to do it. That's not too smart.
Well, in the first place, the court's going to hear all of that, and but the jury might not.
The judges hear it, the jury's not going to hear it, but it does not give the viewpoint to the people there that the lawyer is on the same side as his client. And if they don't feel it and he doesn't feel it, that's not good. The most important thing over here is to make the client believe he's in control of his case, but really you're in control of the case. So how do you handle something like that?
So there was no guilt or innocent trial in this.
He pled guilty.
So there was a trial, though, and that was on punishment. And Susan Ashley, how much better situation did Mr. Chester give his lawyer in the punishment phase?
Well, Mr. Chester testified at the punishment phase, and what comes out at the punishment phase is his testimony is basically his testimony. He himself testifies that if he's given life in prison, he would like to kill corrections officers. If he's given death, he would ask his homies to go kill cops. He also testified that he regretted he didn't kill the two young girls he sexually assaulted. And he testified that he thought all this was fun. And also, don't forget, he had given a confession before. So his confession also came out. In his confession, he expressed that he was filled with hate for white people. Also, at the punishment phase, his other extraneous offenses, which hadn't been adjudicated, but they would come in as to extraneous bad acts, he got out of prison in March 97. And this case that he's on trial for happens in February of 98. Between March 97 and February of 98, he went on a crime spree that left 5 people dead, 5 people shot, 25 burglaries. He had committed 25 burglaries, 3 sexual assaults.
And he talked about all this?
3 sexual assaults in the course of the burglaries, and he shot a dog.
And he... The evidence didn't come from other sources, but him.
Him. And not that, I mean, I guess you could say some of his victims were young children, young girls that he had raped, like a 10-year-old girl, elderly woman, an 87-year-old woman. One of his victims that he had killed was a former co-worker that I guess he was trying to steal her stuff, and she resisted, and he killed her. Another one of the people he had shot and killed was a man that was his former brother-in-law that he was committing a burglary with. And before the burglary was over, he shot him and left him in the home. And that basically his testimony at punishment, I guess you could say he did a better job than the state ever thought about.
Jim?
Well, let me explain how this works. And we talked about this before. It's the client's absolutely right to testify, even though you don't want him to. He has that right. And the only thing I know to do in something like that is try to argue that this indicates that he's a bubble off plum and try to get some sympathy that way. That's what you've got to do. But clients absolutely, it's their decision to take the stand. And I think Mike is absolutely right. When you disagree with your client, I don't think you should ever take a position in open court saying you disagree with him. You should do that privately. It's like airing your dirty linen in front of the judge, and it makes your client feel badly towards you. They should never do that.
This is not a pretty case.
No, it's not.
Pat Hartwell, you're calling in. I take it that you're reporting something. Pat?
Your name's Pat?
Yep.
Hold on one second. Hello?
Hello, Pat. This is Ray. You called.
Yes, we have with us some of Elroy Chester's family, and we have a sister, Zelma, who would like to talk to him on the radio.
Okay.
Here she is right here.
Hello, Zelma.
Hello.
Zelma, you're on the air. What can we do for you?
Hi. I was just wanting to say that we are all victims in this situation, and the state of Texas really needs to do away with the death row penalty execution.
Well, you're talking to the already converted.
Okay.
But thank you very much, and good to hear your voice. When's the last time you saw Elroy?
I just saw him this morning.
Okay. How was he holding up under all of this?
He was under good spirits.
Okay.
Yes,
well,
give
our regards, our love, and our sympathy to the rest of the family, and we would appreciate that.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right.
All right. We go to...
The big issue in this case, the big issue, and in fact, his conduct is kind of leads into it. The big issue on appeal is whether or not he was mentally retarded. Larry's going to discuss that and what happened at the writ level. That's when they brought up what we call the Atkins issue, where he claims he's mentally retarded.
There is clearly, as you put it earlier, that he's a couple of points off plumb.
Well, yeah, it's pretty obvious from his conduct afterwards. Sure. I mean, conduct at trial is just almost saying it's insane somehow.
Well, you know, it's funny things happen at trial.
I mean,
I go way back. I remember the Leslie Douglas Ashley case.
Oh, yeah.
And Carolyn Lima and Leslie Douglas Ashley did quite a performance in front
Didn't
of
Jack Knight defend her?
I think so.
Yeah, I know Jack. Well, we talked about his son.
Yeah. That was, I mean, I actually knew Leslie. And that whole bizarre behavior in court, I don't, every day they'd go to court and the jury was trying to figure out how can we do something different here.
I remember one time I was defending a guy and he got nervous. He laughed and he laughed throughout the trial. I kept worrying the jury would give me some time for sitting next to him. I wanted to put a sack on his head.
One important thing is when he told the jury that if he was not arrested, that he would keep on killing, that was pretty much as much. I can't think of what more you could say to a jury to get them to give you death.
Remember, DeGarmo said much the same thing over in Fort Bend County years ago, because he told the jurors, if you turn me loose, I bet all your names, I'll come back and kill all you SOBs.
I mean, I don't.
And they accommodated him.
Right, I can't see what more he could have done to get the jury to give him death.
Larry, why shouldn't we believe this guy's completely crazy?
I'm not saying that you should or shouldn't, Ray, but having been found guilty and given the death penalty, some of his behavior and his history might have suggested to some that he's mentally retarded. So on appeal, the Atkins issues were raised as to whether, since the Supreme Court in Atkins decided that executing mentally retarded people is cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. And Atkins is then applied to Texas through Briceño. And what Briceño does, which has been consistently done, is determine the factors that are used in determining retardation, and that is significantly sub-average mental capacity onset at an early time in life, both of which were found to be substantiated by the preponderance of the evidence, which is the standard. And there's also the limited adaptive skills. And that on that one, the Court of Criminal Appeals says that he had not proven limited adaptive skills by preponderance of the evidence, and so that became the real issue as to how do you determine that his adaptive skills were deficient. And the argument seemed to be, what are the factors to be used in determining that? And do you just look at Briceño and say the question in Briceño, that is, if the people that knew him when he was younger said he was stupid or crazy, and they came up and testified to that? Or do you look at other things, whether the factors in Briseño were the exhaustive factor, whether they covered everything? And in his case, there were so many factors in terms of his planning the offenses that he committed. That is, bringing gloves and implements of burglaries.
It didn't do him any good to bring gloves because he left a trail about 3 miles wide. I mean, Oklahoma City tornadoes couldn't have left a wider trail.
Here's the thing that they always look at, and people need to emphasize this. The thing, when you're saying someone's insane, the thing they always look at is your conduct immediately afterwards. Did you do anything to demonstrate you knew what you did was wrong? This is why Andrea Gates presented a problem, because after she killed her children, she called the police. Well, why would you call the police if you didn't know what you did was wrong? By the same token, on mental retardation, what they look at is your conduct prior to and during the crime. That's what probably the most important factor. If you're saying you're mentally retarded in this particular case, what they looked at was the following. Number one, he cased a house. Number two, he wore gloves. He carried with him a mask to hide himself. He had a wire cutter so he cut telephone wires. And it was planned, not like, and then he lied about where the murder weapon was kept.
Well, aren't they changing the rules on
what happened? Let me tell you what the real problem is. DSM, which is called the Diagnostical Statistic Manual, is a Bible for psychiatrists. Coming out May 15th, they're coming out with a brand new edition, and they're changing the definition. They're going to call it mental retard. It's going to be called mental impairment. And what they're going to do, they're pretty well eliminating the 70. It used to be the cutoff number for an IQ test was 70. In this case, this defendant took 5 IQ tests. This was when he was younger. And out of 4 out of 5, he scored under 70 on both of them. In fact, that's what the dissenting opinion said in the Fifth Circuit. They pointed to the test that he took and that he never scored above 70 except in one. And what the new definition of mental retardation is going to do is going to eliminate the arbitrary number of 70. They're saying we can give IQ tests, but we're going to have an arbitrary number saying above or below. That means you're mentally retarded. They're eliminating the 70 bell mark. And the next thing they're going to eliminate is the age of 18, because currently the way they defined it, you got to have a IQ below 70, you got to have lack of adaptive skills, and it's got to have an onset before the age of 18. And what they're going to do is eliminate the 70 number, and they're going to eliminate the age 18, talk about you must demonstrate that your lack of adaptive skills and IQ during your formative years. That's going to be the new definition coming May the 18th.
Now, in the formative years, it's supposed to be some kind of sliding scale?
No one knows what that means yet.
The court's going to have to define it.
Well, what happened, the court followed. The big problem with the Atkins case is when the Supreme Court said you can't kill mentally retarded people, they didn't find what mental retardation was. So it left the courts to decide, and they adopted what DSM said before. Now, we don't know whether they're going to keep the old definition or if they're going to take the new DSM definition. We don't know that yet. But all the death penalty lawyers are very worried about it because you hone in usually on the IQ, and they're going to say there's no arbitrary number anymore.
Mercy.
So that may very well open the floodgates for more death penalty and killing claims and claiming you're mentally retarded.
Do you have any other reading on this?
Well, and also on the adaptive skills deficiency, that's what specifically the one that they lost. What Chester's lawyers were arguing, saying you need to look at his adaptive skills during his formative years. And so they went back to when he was growing up. But the court keeps going. The decision was based on his adaptive skills at the time of the offense. Cheshire's lawyer was suggesting that, well, that's not what you look at, because you got to look at it when you're growing up. And the court says, no, we can look at everything, the adaptive skills, even at the time of the offense. And there were considerable adaptive skills. I mean, he was able to find duct tape in a dark garage at a house he didn't live in, but he'd burglarized before. So that suggested to some that at least at the time of the offense, he seemed to have fairly advanced adaptive skills.
Thank you, Larry. Gloria is out there. And Gloria, could you tell Elizabeth to see if she can find Kate?
Okay.
But Gloria, before we get Kate on, you shared with me, you emailed me a documentary short documentary concerning the Dwayne Buck case. Right. Where did that come from?
It came from the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, and they have been doing an incredible amount of work on Dwayne's case. In fact, last night they showed that film at Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church.
Well, Wheeler Avenue Baptist Church icon is there, is part of it, yeah.
Well, yeah, he's part of the video, and it was really excellent. It's only like half minutes, but you get information from so many people, from Rodney Ellis to Dwayne Buck's sister, Phyllis, that he actually shot, and you really see how critical the issue of race is to the death penalty in Texas.
And Dwayne Buck's, this documentary, Dwayne Buck's, deals with an expert witness that was presented during the punishment phase of his trial.
Right, Dr. Keanu.
To establish future dangerousness, who also testified in a half a dozen other trials.
Exactly.
And the other people, all except Dwayne Buck, got resentencing hearings.
They did. And they say, even at the time, John Cornyn, Mr. Conservative of the Year,
who was State Attorney General.
Yeah, he was AG. He thought Dwayne should have gotten a rehearing. But what happened was, and this really proves how incompetent Dwayne's trial attorney was, his own attorney called Dr. Keanu. So they're saying since he was a defense witness, then that disqualifies him. But it was questioning from the prosecution that brought out this
So there is a thread. Now, if people wanted to see that documentary, they would go to YouTube and search Dwayne Buck?
I would go to the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's webpage.
Okay, the NAACP Legal Defense Fund's webpage. Mm-hmm. And if you can't get it there, because YouTube as a whole is searchable.
That's true.
And
that's
you
true.
Can do that. Okay.
But it's excellent. It really...
Gloria, we miss your voice in Huntsville, but we're glad we've got you in the studio. How about plugging Abolition Movement one more time?
Well, what I want to say is the next execution on the 26th is 500. The bus will be leaving from Shape Center at 2 o'clock that afternoon. It's a Wednesday.
If Kimberly gets a stay.
I hope so.
Yeah, that is in the wind that Kimberly, because she got not a stay but a delay the last time.
She's gotten two.
And she got a stay and then she got the delay.
Right.
And the issue is not fully resolved from the delay, so there's a good chance. But, you know, Kimberly.
Her attorney is Maury Levin, and I emailed Maury, and she wrote me back and said, you know, getting a stay in Texas, as you know, is slim. So we're working, but that's all I can say. Keep all your appendages crossed.
Keep tuned to the spot. We are not going to let the 500th execution in Texas since the Furman case pass quietly into the night. Thank you, Gloria.
Oh, hell no.
Thank you, Gloria. Okay. Oh, by the way, Gloria, at www.abolitionmovement.org.
Correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
And now we've got Kate Black on the radio. Kate, all the lawyers here expressed disappointment that you weren't in studio with us.
Oh, thank you. I'm sorry I couldn't make it in person.
Well, what's going on in this case?
Well, as Gloria said, we released this video that is incredibly powerful and moving, and I encourage everyone to go to the LDF website and view it. And we recently had a meeting with community leaders and activists who are just really showing concern, and we're waiting for the Court of Criminal Appeals in Austin to rule on our current pending appeal.
The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals is... it's kind of situated kind of like the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals these days, where they're having musical chairs.
It is.
Does Dwayne actually have a date at this point?
He doesn't. And that's one of the things that, you know, community leaders and interested parties are really working towards, is convincing the Harris County District Attorney's Office, no matter what the CCA does, not to set an execution date.
Okay. Okay. Are you, number one, how did you get on the case?
I was working at the Texas Defender Service in 2011 when Dwayne Buck first received his 2011 execution date, and I was brought on to do his clemency petition. And it was during that research that we discovered the testimony Gloria was talking about, the Dr. Quijano's testimony that Mr. Buck would be more dangerous because he was black. So we realized that hadn't been litigated, and we went ahead and filed.
Actually, John Cornyn kind of joined you initially about that testimony, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in 2000, he identified Mr. Buck as someone who deserved a resentencing hearing. Unfortunately, when we filed our appeal in 2011, the Attorney General's position had changed, and we don't know why.
But Cornyn was gone by then.
He was, yeah. It's a different Attorney General now.
A different Attorney General down now. And is their position hanging on a thread that the witness from which this testimony was elicited was called by the defense?
It is, and it's really unfortunate because it's extremely misleading. When John Cornyn identified those six cases you mentioned in which Dr. Quijano unconstitutionally testified, three out of the six were called by the defense. So there's really no distinction between Mr. Buck's case and others who have received new sentencing hearings.
So the only thing that really changed is who is sitting in the AG's office.
It really does. And we're hoping that someone will step in and that state officials will realize that it can't be an arbitrary decision like that based on, you know, who's in office, but that Mr. Buck deserves the same equal protection as the other defendants who receive their sentencing hearings.
Ms. Black, I am surrounded by criminal defense lawyers. Actually, I am a minority of persons that is not a criminal defense lawyer in this room. Isn't there a lot of stress dealing with the cases of this gravity?
Certainly, a high stress job, but it's cases like these that are just so clear cut and so outrageous and just so easy to explain to people. People hear about this case and they want to know what they can do. They can't believe that this happened in the modern era. And so cases like these make it definitely worth doing.
And in your actual practice defending Mr. Buck, it's not about your opinion of executions or anything. It's about Mr. Buck, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, our concentration is on Mr. Buck and his right to a racially untinged sentence. And I think it's been really impressive, all the different people who have come together. Some are in support of the death penalty and some are against it. But everyone's really come together and said, we have to have a colorblind justice system.
Ms. Black, I would probably get my wrist slapped if I allowed you to get off the phone without expressing from our producer, Elizabeth Stein, if it would be all right for us to call you back.
Of course. Absolutely.
And I thank you very much for being on Execution Watch tonight.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Ray, let me clarify just a little bit about the Keonis thing. A lot of folks don't realize the background. Keonis had been a psychologist working for DDC. He was very instrumental in getting the classification set up at TDC. He's a psychologist, not a psychiatrist. He then retired and went to Conroe, and what he had done and all the studies he claimed he had done, he had this kind of scale on what made people violent. For example, men tend to be more violent than women. Old people tend to be less violent than young people. And he also claimed, and he testified in death penalties punishment statutes, that African Americans tend to be more violent than non-African Americans. And that's where he got in trouble. In every one of those cases, except this Buck case, they have reversed it for a new punishment hearing because they say under no circumstances can you ever consider ethnic background as a factor to give the death penalty.
And that's
period.
Clear. I mean, that's
real clear.
That's not.
And it doesn't make a nickel's worth of difference who brings it. You got to understand the voucher rule. Let me explain what I mean by that. Years ago, we had a really foolish thing that if you sponsored a witness, you vouch for their credibility and you're stuck with it. That was knocked out a long time ago in a case called Chambers versus Mississippi years ago. Now, it doesn't make a nickel's worth of difference whether Christ himself called this psychiatrist or psychologist. The rule is real simple. You cannot use ethnic background is a factor to say somebody is more violent than a nun. Can't do it. I don't care who brings the evidence in. For some reason, Buck, and I think because of that, of our new Attorney General, Abbott, they've changed, and he should get a new punishment hearing. Everybody agrees with that, except these morons in the Attorney General's office.
You can get away with
and
that.
That's basically,
you can get away with that on this show.
Well.
Jack, you're not in favor of the morons in the Attorney General's office, are you?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Oh, okay. Okay. So I put Jack on the spot.
That's
there.
All right.
I'm picking on Jack because he's a little more conservative than I am. But you, what is your piece of the puzzle, Jack?
Well, you know, I want to talk about what's going on with the Fifth Circuit. The Fifth Circuit's important because they are the ones who can grant a grant a stay. They can grant they can ask for a. There are all kinds of things that they can do to get the trial court to do.
Okay. How would you get to the Fifth Circuit? Is through the federal appeals process?
Yes, you'd
begin in a federal district court, and then the next step is the
Fifth Circuit, then yeah. you eventually would appeal to the Supreme Court. What happened here in the controversy that's happened with Judge Jones is that sometime in February, she went to a Federalist Society talk, and she gave a speech about over various issues about the death penalty and the issues that were coming up, including the mental retardation and actual innocence issues. There was a lot of controversy that happened because, among other things, what she said was that the arguments of actual innocence and of mental retardation were really red herrings, and that if you started to believe them, that it would lead to a slippery slope. This causes concern.
So actual innocence is a slippery slope somewhere.
That the arguments that most of the arguments for of actual innocence and of mental retardation were red herrings. That they were not to be believed. They were delay tactics, and that if you started to believe them, that it would lead to a slippery slope. One would assume of anything goes. And the complaints about her were that she made these statements, and as a result of that, she was asked to recuse herself from any kind of dealings with on this case, and she refused to recuse herself, and the Fifth Circuit put together a different panel to review this case in light of what happened in the Federalist Society speech that she gave. The concern that we have here is that if she is predisposed not to believe any arguments of actual innocence or of mental retardation, then in the future, attorneys really ought to consider filing motions to recuse whenever she's on a panel, because if she's disinclined to believe any of these and she's actually come out and said, I'm sorry, I'm just not buying it. She's not looking at this.
She's not approaching the issue with an open mind.
That's correct. And this is really the controversy
and
behind.
Mr. Chester's attorneys raised this issue.
Actually, it was a bunch of other. Civil rights organizations and ethicists who signed on and filed a complaint against Judge Jones.
Who would decide that complaint?
The Fifth Circuit would be charged with.
Like the chief judge of the Fifth Circuit and the majority.
Let me kind of interject and explain a little bit more carefully about this. What happened? The sole and only issue in the subsequent was whether or not he was mentally retarded. They litigated that in state court. The state judge said he didn't meet the test. The nine judges on the Court of Criminal Appeals agreed that he failed to prove that he's mentally retarded. Now it goes to the Fifth Circuit, and they have a panel of three people. And they decide one thing. Was the Court of Criminal Appeals correctly applying the law? Well, guess who wrote the major opinion in that case?
Edith Jones. Mm-hmm.
So Edith Jones wrote the major opinion, and something that people have overlooked, there was a pretty strong dissenting opinion in that case. The vote was 2-1. Hmm. And the two judges, the judges sided with Judge Edith Jones, said this, that the Mr. This Chester did not meet the test for mental, failed to prove he's mentally retarded. It's a real strong dissenting opinion in this case. Now, after that opinion came out and they rejected his mental retardation claim, she went to the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and she was sponsored by the Heritage Society. Okay. And while she was speaking at the University of Pennsylvania, she said the following things: that the Atkins versus Virginia case that created an exception to mentally retarded people not being executed provided a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. And she criticized the Supreme Court decision. Then she said this claims of mental retardation and actual innocence are red herrings. And she specifically mentioned six cases in which it was a red herring. Guess one of the cases she mentioned? This particular case on the Elroy Chester. And she additionally said to that, she implied, and again, we don't have a transcript.
Is it ethical for her to do that?
Well, it's not supposed to, but she's done, hasn't bothered her a whole lot before in criminal. I understand she's well thought of in civil circles, but among criminal circles, she's not very well thought of.
I've been there in a civil case. Yeah, I know Edith Jones. I was there whenever she was early appointed by Reagan. I went there on the Baker case and Baker v. Wade case, and right in the middle of the en banc oral arguments. I mean, it was a fascinating case. Here, Judge Rubin was trying to help the Baker attorneys, and he was saying, well, you're going to give equal justice to these people and you're going to give equal justice to those people, what's wrong with the people here you're going to deny it to? How do you divide equal justice up like that? And right in the middle of that fascinating argument where the state was sweating blood, Edith Jones turns on her microphone and said, nobody is saying anything here today about the plot by homosexuals to take over this country. And then there was this long, pregnant pause.
Homosexuals can get pregnant.
The pause can get pregnant.
I understand.
And then they realized that, well, maybe she's right. Nobody is saying anything about a plot by homosexuals to take over the country. And they just went on with what they were talking about and completely ignore her outburst.
That's all you can do.
Yeah. But you understand that when I've been dead for 500 years, there will be a written record of that hearing in a book somewhere.
And answer your question earlier, what happened? Whenever you think a judge is out of line, your complaint is filed with the chief judge of the Fifth Circuit. That's where the complaint is filed. Mm-hmm. Now, in this particular...
A position which she has previously had.
Previously had, exactly. Now, in this case, it makes it particularly interesting because she authored the opinion rejecting the retardation claim. She authored that. And now what's happened, they have filed a complaint with the chief judge. Now, what lends some credibility, because one of the things that have been criticized, that, well, you didn't have a transcript, you don't remember what occurred. But the lawyer defending Chester has filed a request and requested three things from the Fifth Circuit. Number one, give us a state of execution. Number two, withdraw the opinion that either Jones had written and get a new panel to hear it, mm-hmm. and reissue a different opinion and disqualify her from sitting on this case in the future. Now, what the Fifth Circuit did. Now, remember, when that petition was filed, it was all supported by affidavits from a lawyer saying that she made these statements. And I'm going to tell you something. You're not going to go into federal court and attack a federal judge and making comments that are scurrilous that you can't back up.
That's right.
And that's what gives some credibility, in my opinion, to people remembering what occurred. Now, what happened, what the Fifth Circuit has done, they did not grant a stay of execution. Obviously, that's why we're here. And number two, they did not say we're going to have a new panel look at the Atkins issue, the mental retardation issue. All they're going to do is refer it to another panel to decide whether or not they should review the case.
And
that's what's happened.
The new panel
didn't change. Granted review, and apparently, obviously, we're not going to do it because we're having an execution going on now. So they obviously haven't.
Here's, I think, the point with Edith Jones in terms of this case is, look, it may be that this case does not meet the test. Okay. the problem here with Edith Jones and what she's expressed in these speeches, she's expressing a hostility towards what's considered current case law, okay? And she's clearly hostile to that. And the judge's duty is to follow current case law and acceptable, in other words, follow the current precedent, follow case law, follow the decisions made by the U.S. Supreme Court and implement it. If your opinion is that you're so hostile to what is current law.
If this was your case, what would you do?
I would ask for her to be recused. In fact, if she was a judge in a dog show and my dog was going in, I would ask for she to be recused.
I mean, Edith Jones is like a bona fide nut.
It's not fair. That's the whole point. If somebody is so hostile.
Empirically, in the Fifth Circuit, have you ever been to the Fifth Circuit Court in New Orleans? I mean, you've never saw so much mahogany in your life. It is dark, beautiful, grained, carefully maintained, great. The seats are even comfortable in the Fifth Circuit. And I sat there in amazement as this woman made a complete ass of herself in a black robe. And I sat there and looked at the shock on Judge Rubin's face. I looked at the shock on Judge Thornberry's face. His bow tie wiggled. And Judge Thornberry never wiggled his bow tie. But the whole of the court was horrified. She hadn't only been there a few months.
Well, I think it also, look, it also shows this, that anybody who's, shall we say, in common reality with the rest of us are basically going to know that you are supposed to, whether you agree with the law or not, you're supposed to apply it and follow it, even though you may not agree with it.
We haven't heard from Huntsville yet, but Pat is subject to call in. We have only a few minutes left in the show. Elroy Chester may have not survived this point. I'll ask the producer to give a call to Pat and see if anything has happened there. But during the interim period, Gloria, our erstwhile reporter, who is normally in Huntsville, but with us today, has found it. We have been talking around where to get your eyes on that documentary for the last hour, and we have found out exactly where to get your eyes. It's not the American Civil Liberties Union. It is not even YouTube. You go to www.NAACP PDLF, the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP. And it is obvious. NAACPLDF.org. Is that right, Gloria?
That's correct.
And thank you very much for fishing this out for us, because I want everybody listening to this show, and let me tell you something about who listens to this show, because I happen to know. Most of the listeners to this show are not in this country. Hmm. When we're on broadcast, the guys on death row can hear this show. And I think that is a very important element of our audience. I've been doing radio at KPFT, except for 5 years off for bad behavior, since its very inception. And except for the time I was in prison, I was on the radio, on this radio station. And I want you all to know that that you could not do this show on another radio station. It could not be done. Nobody is going to put that much energy and that much effort. No one is going to have 5 qualified practicing legal defense lawyers, maybe one semi-retired, but one of the brightest minds in Texas criminal defense. Nobody's going to put that team together. Nobody's going to find an Elizabeth Stein to go do all of the work that is necessary. Nobody's going to find a Gloria Ruback, who is normally in Huntsville. Nobody's going to have a Dave Atwood, who is at a demonstration here. Nobody's going to do all of that and make this work. This radio station needs and deserves your tax-deductible support. And I'm very pleased that the audience all over the world, as a matter of fact, I even got an email this afternoon from Mark Parkinson, who is in England, who says, it's midnight and I'll be listening to your show. And he gave me some hellos to say, but they were all criminal defense lawyers, and I trust that they're working on cases. So, yes.
There's one thing I think we should mention, that elections matter. And I will ask Ray and Jim the question. Let's tell our listeners who appointed Edith Jones.
Ronald Reagan.
Okay. Elections matter.
Elections matter. I want to thank all of the staff of the show, which has been remarkable. It's always remarkable to work with these folks. I come in early and watch them put all this together. I want to thank Pat Hartwell for covering us in Huntsville. I want to thank Dave Atwood, Jim Skelton, Susan Ashley, Larry Douglas, Michael Gillespie, and Jack Lee. All of them were on here tonight, and all of them did a remarkable job. Gloria's got her hand up, and the teacher always recognizes students with their hands up.
I want to invite people to join us for the Juneteenth parade out in Acres Homes on Saturday the 22nd. And Dwayne Buck's family is going to be riding and marching with us.
Acres Homes, give us a street address and a zip.
Oh, hell. It's it's on West Montgomery at the Multi-Service Center.
Multi-Service Center. Go to the city website, West Montgomery Multi-Service Center. It may be Acres Homes Social Multi-Service Center.
Right.
Get out there. And Juneteenth is a big, important Texas holiday. It is the day in which slaves in Texas were told that they were free.
Except in Texas prisons.
Except in Texas prisons. And we're working on the exclusionary clause. Our producer is Elizabeth Stein, who's the hardest working one among us. We thank her. We want to thank our technical directory, Director Otis McClay. And we've got managing the board tonight is Doyle, who does an exceptional job. The theme music was written and is performed by Victoria Panetti, and you can find her at She Monster International at myspace.com. Thank you very much, and have a good evening.